The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm Brad McDonald, and I'll be your host today. Stephen Flurry is currently making his way back to the UK from America. This is a pretty historic day for the Trumpet Daily radio program. This is the first program from our new studio here in the loft at Edstone Hall. We just finished putting the door to the studio on yesterday. The sound and recording equipment was set up this morning. We haven't had a whole lot of time to do any testing, so I hope it reaches your ears, Trumpet audience. I've titled today's program, News You Probably Haven't Seen or Heard. I'm being a little facetious. Our Trumpet Daily Radio listeners probably are at least aware of some of the developments that we're going to talk about on today's program. But people who receive most of their news or receive their news from the mainstream media probably haven't heard too much about some of the issues that we'll be talking about today. And that's my point. Each week, there are important stories. There are important events and developments happening in the world that just aren't being covered by the BBC, by CNN, even by Fox News, even by a lot of the conservative media. And this in itself is a major piece of news. The way the news media is ignoring or even marginalizing news and events that really are critical to the successful functioning of society and to our communities and our families and our nations. The idea for this program came to me one evening this week. My two-year-old suggested that we watch the news. Watch news, Dad. Watch news, Dad, is what she said. And it's not because she's a huge news buff. She's only two. I think it's more that she just wants to see the TV screen light up and then hope that we flick past the news to a cartoon or something like that. Anyway, at Sage's behest, I turned on the evening news this week. I can't remember if it was BBC or ITV. But the lead story in the news that night was the story about Boris Johnson's remarks about Muslim women in the burqa. In case you haven't heard, which means you've probably been holed up in a cave somewhere in Afghanistan. But Boris Johnson, the former foreign secretary here in the UK, said this week that, or last week I think it was, he wrote that Muslim women wearing burqas look like letterboxes or bank robbers. And I think that was a Telegraph article where he wrote that, but the story exploded. Apparently, this is the worst remark ever made by a politician in the history of mankind. It has consumed all of the major media outlets here in the UK over the past week or two. So as I mentioned, this story dominated the news cycle for the past 2 weeks. It was the lead story when I turned on the news this week with Sage to watch a little TV. And it was a little frustrating because the same day, just a few hours before I turned on the BBC to watch the news, I'd read another piece of news. At the same time that the BBC and all of these other mainstream news sources were blitzing us with news about Boris Johnson's remark, the news broke this week of another Muslim grooming gang that had been arrested for molesting British girls. This gang was operating in Huddersfield, which is in north of England, close to Leeds in Yorkshire. 31 Muslim Asian men, or 30 men and one woman, were charged. They were arrested this week on charges of rape and trafficking and then other sexual offenses. The victims of these men were girls aged between 12 and 18. Most of the girls were from 12 to 15 years old. This is Britain's largest sex abuse ring. And this isn't the first, let's say, Muslim rape gang that has been exposed here in England. Over the past few years, gangs like this have been exposed in places like Rotherham, Rockdale, Telford. I mean, there's probably been at least a dozen or more cases like this. But this week, these 31 individuals were arrested this week. And you can't find that news in the mainstream media. I mean, the institutions or organizations like BBC and ITV, I was able to find it, but they reported, they didn't put it on their front page news. They didn't put it on the nightly news. It was a short article near the bottom of the BBC's website. This is a major and widespread problem here in the UK. And these Muslim grooming gangs are becoming a much greater problem all across Europe. Yet whenever another gang is exposed, it barely makes the news. Certainly not front page news or the nightly news. And certainly it doesn't make the news in the way that Boris Johnson's remark did. 30 Muslim men were arrested for molesting young girls, and there's barely a whisper. But Boris Johnson makes a politically incorrect remark, and that's all we hear about for 2 weeks. A one-sentence observation from Boris Johnson is more important than the arrest of 31 men for sexually abusing teenage girls. This is news that you didn't see. Maybe you did. If you're really watching the news, you might have come across it. But if you're consuming your news from sources like the BBC or ITV or any of the mainstream media, you probably didn't see that. You probably didn't know that 30 men were arrested this week they were part of an organized group for grooming and molesting young teenage girls. What's wrong with Britain's media? What's wrong with its leaders? Where's the moral compass here? Where's the sense of duty to defend the people? Where's the desire, the urge to confront evil? See, if this story was reported on, if it received any attention, then it would have aroused all sorts of questions. Questions about Britain's immigration policies, questions about, you know, what kind of solutions are there. I mean, really, there's an opportunity in this story. There's an opportunity for Britain to come to understand a very serious problem that exists in this country. And there's an opportunity here to not just understand what is a serious problem, but then to start talking about how to solve it. But the British mainstream media can't even talk about the problem. They're not even prepared to talk at length about the problem, let alone actually explore the causes and any solutions. It reminds me of an end time prophecy in the book of Isaiah. Mr. Gerald Flurry, the editor-in-chief of The Trumpet, has written about this prophecy in Isaiah and in the book we have on Churchill. But in Isaiah chapter 56, the prophet writes, "The beasts of the field come to devour." That's an apt description. That's an apt description. "The beasts of the field come to devour. Yes, all you beasts in the forest." Verse 10 says, "But his watchmen are blind. They are all ignorant. They are all dumb dogs. They cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber." So the beasts of the field are approaching. The beasts of the field are lurking. The beasts of the field are picking off our people. They've come to devour us. But his watchmen, Israel's watchmen, Britain's watchmen, America's watchmen, are blind, they're ignorant, they're all dumb dogs, they cannot bark, sleeping, lying down, loving to slumber. Yes, verse 11 says, yes, they are greedy dogs which can never have enough, and they are shepherds that cannot understand. I mean, what an apt description. I mean, there's a spiritual application here to the leaders of the Church of God, or the part of the church that fell away. But then there's also an end time application to the nations of Israel. Our leaders, our media, They're shepherds that don't understand. They all look to their own ways, Isaiah writes. Everyone for his gain. They all look to their own ways. Everyone's interested in furthering their ideology, furthering their pet philosophy. Everyone's interested in, everyone's looking out for his own gain, Isaiah says, from his quarter. Verse 12 says, come, say they, I will fetch wine, and we will fill ourselves with strong drink, and tomorrow shall be as this day, and much more abundant. So they just live life as if nothing's the matter. These beasts of the field are on the prowl. They're circling the homestead. These dogs are aware of it, but they just sleep all day and they sleep all night. That's really the way, that's the way our media behaves. That's the way so many leaders behave. But just observing the way Britain's media latched onto Boris Johnson, yet virtually ignored news of another grooming gang, it just got me, it got me wondering how much important or significant news is happening that people simply aren't aware of because the media isn't reporting it. Or, you know, perhaps it's an important piece of news or it's an important news event that is being reported on, but the analysis is shallow or misguided. The news is just kind of mentioned in passing. They're not stopping to really evaluate it, to learn the lessons, to talk about solutions, to identify the cause of whatever the issue is, whatever the problem is. When you start looking at the news this way and start looking at events in this way, you really do see that this is happening daily. This is happening daily, every day. Significant trends and developments are unfolding, and they're simply being ignored or being marginalized, or maybe they're being reported on, but just in a really shallow way. In a lot of instances, some of this really important news that is going unreported, if it was reported on, it would actually give the viewer and give the nation an opportunity to really understand a serious problem. It would create an opportunity for the country, for the leaders, for the thinkers in the nation to address a problem, to come up with some solutions. But in so many cases, the news media just fails to even sufficiently report on the event or the trend or the development. I have another example here. You might have heard, I'm not sure. It wasn't exactly secret or covered up, but at the same time, it was mentioned quite briefly, and then the news cycle just moved on. But on Monday this week in Sweden, more than 100 cars were set on fire in what appears to be a coordinated attack. Again, this story made the news, but it wasn't necessarily front page news, and it didn't stay in the news cycle for too long. And beyond that, I haven't really seen anyone, except for maybe one or two individuals, but I haven't seen anyone dig into this subject and really explore the meaning of what happened in Sweden on Monday night, and then draw the lessons inherent within the events that happened in Sweden on Monday night. But as I said, on Monday, more than 100 cars were set on fire in four or five cities across Sweden. Most of the damage occurred in the city of Gothenburg, but there are also cars set alight in Malmö, Trollhättan, Falkenberg, and Stockholm. All of the perpetrators, all we know is that the perpetrators, or we've been told that the perpetrators, were gangs of youth who were dressed in black. And the attacks were very obviously extremely well coordinated, probably on smartphones, but they occurred at the same time in, as I said, four or five different places across Sweden. Sweden's prime minister was livid the day after these attacks. He used some pretty choice language to lambast the perpetrators. And he just asked what the expletive is going on here. I think part of the reason, maybe this is just a bit of a jaded view, but part of the reason for his strong response was that in 3 weeks Sweden goes to the polls. There's a national election, and he probably wants to be seen as responding strongly and firmly and aggressively to this attack. But just reading the news, I mean, like I said, this was reported on. But if you read nearly all the articles reporting on these attacks in Sweden on Monday night, they all say that the motive is unknown. But then if you do a little bit of digging, if you put some things together, if you look at the history of attacks like this in Sweden over the past few years, you can begin to get a picture of the cause and who was responsible for these attacks in Sweden. There's enough evidence to indicate the most likely cause. The cities in which these attacks, for example, have large immigrant and migrant populations. One interesting fact came out yesterday. 3 men have been arrested. 1 man was arrested fleeing to Turkey. But as I said, nearly every article about these attacks in Sweden ignores some key information. Nearly every article you read about this really doesn't talk about who was behind these attacks. I'll give you an example. This is from the BBC article on these attacks in Sweden. This is from August 14th, so I guess that's Wednesday. The BBC wrote, "There is no clear motive for the widespread destruction. 100 cars just burning. But there's no clear motive for the widespread destruction. But the arson echoes the damage done during riots in Stockholm over several nights in May 2013. So the BBC hints that there are similarities to Monday night's fires. There are similarities with some of the riots that occurred in Stockholm in 2013. And if you go back and research who was behind the riots in Stockholm, well, you'll find that it was Muslim migrants. It was immigrants. The only analyst that I could find really talking about this in clear language and actually putting, identifying the perpetrators for what happened in Sweden was Robert Spencer, the director of the website Jihad Watch. And he's a well-known author. He's got a couple of best-selling books. But here's what he wrote. Youths, that's the way the BBC and many reported this. Youths is a frequent establishment media euphemism for Muslims, he wrote. If they were in Britain, they'd be Asians. This is indeed a military operation. It's part of the jihad to bring down the Swedish state and replace it with an Islamic government. I mean, that's the only quote I could find with someone actually talking about the problem, talking about what's really going on here. And again, there are important lessons that can be gleaned from what happened in Sweden this week. There are lessons, not just for the Swedes, there are lessons for Europeans, for the British, there are lessons for Americans from what happened in Sweden on Monday. There's lessons about immigration, there's lessons about multiculturalism. There's lessons about liberal ideologies and where they lead. There's an opportunity here. There's an opportunity here for a widespread discussion about what is a serious threat. And there's an opportunity here for Sweden and for other countries too. If they were prepared to really study this and think about it and learn from it, there's an opportunity here for Sweden to maybe address the threat, to come up with some solutions for solving some of the issues they're having with migrants. But that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen because the mainstream media isn't even prepared to talk about it. They're not even prepared to recognize the cause of Monday night's chaos and destruction. So how can you come up with solutions? How can you have a national conversation if you're not even prepared to talk about the cause of the problem? As I said, There are lessons for Americans. Sweden's a long way from America, but America right now, there's an ongoing conversation about immigration, and there's lessons here. If only our leaders and the journalists and the thinkers were prepared to talk about what happened in Sweden on Monday. For the longest time, Sweden, Scandinavia, but Sweden especially, has had pretty liberal views when it comes to migrants and to immigration. In 2014, when the migration from North Africa and the Middle East was really taking off, Sweden's prime minister, he encouraged his people to, quote, open their hearts to migrants. And the Swedish people did. They opened their hearts to the migrants, and they opened their wallets, they opened their homes, they opened their cities and their communities. And over the next few years, more than 600,000 migrants entered Sweden. It was the top destination for Muslim migrants in Europe for a few years. But that has now changed. And that began to change. Maybe last year, it began to change. The Swedes have slowly, reluctantly, without really talking about it too much, more and more Swedes have come to recognize that there was a major problem with their liberal approach to immigration. There was a major problem with multiculturalism. And as I said, they're now beginning to come to terms with the consequences of opening your hearts to migrants. Crime rates are up higher than ever in Sweden. Organized crime is rampant in Sweden. Sweden is now the second most violent nation in Europe. This is Scandinavia. Peace-loving Scandinavia. Last January, Bojan Panzewski, he's a journalist with the Wall Street Journal and Germany's correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. And he wrote, and I don't think he wrote this in an article, he wrote this in a tweet, but he wrote, talking about Sweden, that Sweden is experiencing, quote, an unprecedented surge in shootings, bombings, and sexual crimes, which is mainly restricted to areas predominantly populated by immigrants. So there's lessons here about multiculturalism. There's lessons here about what happens when you have open borders. What happens when you don't really police the flow of migrants into your country. Sweden's example could inform the conversation underway in America about immigration. If this story was even covered, if the mainstream media in America was prepared to really talk about this at length and have a serious conversation about it, there's lessons to be learned. There are going to be political consequences in Sweden. There are going to be political consequences to this really liberal approach to migration. Sweden is having national elections in 3 weeks. I think September 8th or September 9th, they're having national elections. And the nation's far-right anti-immigrant party is expected to do exceptionally well. In fact, polls indicate that the Sweden Democrats will win between 16 and 25% of the vote in the upcoming elections. They're going to win between 16 to 25% of the vote. So worst case scenario, pundits believe, the Sweden Democrats, this far-right party, is going to be the third most popular political party in Sweden. Best case scenario, and one that looks more and more likely, especially in the wake of what happened on Monday, best case scenario is this far-right political party is going to be the number one party in Sweden in 3 weeks. Whatever happens, whatever the end result, the Sweden Democrats are certain now to play a major role in the nation's new government. This far-right nationalist party, a party that some believe has affiliations with Nazism, is about to play a leading role in governing Sweden. And a lot of that is thanks largely to Sweden's liberal immigration policies. people are turning to the Sweden Democrats because they want to crack down on immigration. They want to crack down on migrant crime. And more Swedes agree with them. Again, there's lessons here. There's lessons here for all of us. There's important lessons here for all of us. There's lessons here that really could save America and Britain and other nations a lot of heartache, a lot of trouble, a lot of expense. But no one is really considering these lessons. No one is really learning from what happened in Sweden and what's happening in Sweden, because very few people are prepared to even recognize the cause of a lot of these problems in Sweden. I should probably take a break here in a second, but that's just, I've just covered two examples of significant news events that occurred just this week that you probably didn't know about. Meanwhile, you know, you probably know more than you really want to about the life of Aretha Franklin. Here in Britain, I mean, we've heard all we need to hear, I think, about Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn. Every day brings an important new news event, an important new development, an important trend. Every day, something important is happening, but we don't hear about it. Okay, we'll take a break. And when we come back, I'd like to look at another major news story that you probably haven't heard too much about.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to The Trumpet Magazine. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to The Trumpet Daily radio program. Today we're talking about news you haven't seen or read. The mainstream media consistently marginalizes or just flat out ignores a lot of important news and developments and trends unfolding around us. I'm fairly certain that this next development has been mentioned on this show. I know it's been written about at thetrumpet.com. So our regular followers and listeners are probably aware of this. But if you were to turn on your TV tonight, if you were to watch BBC or CNN, if you were to watch Fox News, I really doubt you would see this piece of news being discussed. This following piece of news is really something that you know, a lot of people think that, you know, really it's for international relations buffs. It's for policy wonks and politicians. But this piece of news is going to affect everyone. It's going to affect all of us here pretty soon. And it's something that really should be on the front page of the Telegraph and the front page of the New York Times and on the BBC tonight. And not just tonight, but over the next, you know, few weeks and few months. I'm talking about the ongoing conversation now, or the conversation now underway in Germany about developing nuclear weapons, developing a nuclear program. This conversation started or got going again about a month ago. The catalyst, I think, mainly was Donald Trump and some of his views on NATO and Germany. I'll just read some quotes here from a couple of articles. This first one comes from Politico. But over the past few weeks, there's been a debate and discussion, a lot of discussion in Germany, particularly among the politicians. But there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not Germany should build a nuclear weapons program and become a nuclear state. This article from Politico was written August 13th. German bomb debate goes nuclear. That's the title. Imagine a nuclear-armed Germany. That's the first sentence. Imagine a nuclear-armed Germany. That's a good thought. That is something worth imagining. But the article, a couple paragraphs down, as Germany's foreign policy establishment becomes increasingly convinced that Donald Trump's aggressive rhetoric toward Berlin and NATO represents a seminal shift in transatlantic relations, some are daring to think the unthinkable. And then it quotes Christian Huck, a prominent German political scientist with a lot of influence in German politics. But Christian Huck, he wrote, "For the first time since 1949, the Federal Republic of Germany is no longer under America's nuclear umbrella. The next step is clear. National defense," this is what Huck wrote, "national defense on the basis of a nuclear deterrent must be given priority in light of new transatlantic uncertainties and potential confrontations. Counting on a European solution to materialize is illusory. Because national interests are too different." Then back to the Politico article. "It would be easy to dismiss the article," Huck's article, "as the ramblings of an eccentric academic. Were Huck not a fixture of Germany's foreign policy establishment and a respected university professor?" So he has a lot of credibility in Germany policymaking. People listen to him. This is, I won't read that quote. This is what an analyst with European Council on Foreign Relations said. "It's crucial for Germany and Europe that we have a strategic debate. What Germany is slowly realizing is that the general structure of the European security system is not prepared for the future." And then the article talks about how Germany's military is in such a poor state. A little further down, "But Trump's persistent criticism of Germany's modest defense spending, currently about half of NATO's 2% of GDP target, is forcing the political class to confront the issue. It's not just Trump. A steady stream of press reports in recent months has revealed the woeful state of Germany's military. In May, for example, only 4 of Germany's 124 Eurofighter jets could actually fly. The Navy and Army faced similar readiness problems." So Donald Trump is saying that Germany needs to give more attention and take more responsibility for Europe's security. They need to spend more. And then Germans are becoming increasingly concerned about their government's ability to defend the country and defend Europe. Only 4 of the nation's 124 Eurofighter jets could actually fly. Where over the next few weeks, we want to produce a video for thetrumpet.com showing how quickly Germany's military situation could change. You know, we want to recognize that Germany's military right now isn't especially robust. As it says here, 4 of Germany's 124 Eurojets can actually fly. It has loads and loads of tanks, but a shocking number of them are just out of commission. But in this video that we want to produce, we just want to show how quickly that could change for Germany. You know, Germany's own military, its own conventional military, may not be, super strong. But German factories are churning out thousands of planes and just tons and tons of military hardware and sending it all around the world, particularly to the Middle East and Saudi Arabia and places like that, the Gulf states. So Germany has the capacity, it has the industrial capacity to produce military hardware, and it is producing military hardware. So it wouldn't be too hard for Germany to boost its conventional military really, really quickly. But, Mr. Trump's remarks about NATO have got a lot of Germans thinking about doing more and even becoming a nuclear state. So this is quite a contentious subject in Germany. Quite a few people are for this, but a lot of people are against it too. Just one more article here. This is from Wolfgang Ischinger. He's the former German ambassador to the United States. He wrote this in Handelsblatt on August 8th. "Germany's dangerous flirtation with nuclear weapons. So you know, this news story is not just about this conversation in Germany underway about whether or not the country should have nuclear weapons. It's bigger than that, as we'll see here in a second. This is what Ischinger writes. As in a game of chess, there are geopolitical moves through which a country can unwittingly checkmate itself. Opening a debate on German nuclear weapons would be such a move. So he thinks Germany is going to checkmate itself. I mean, there's some bridges that you cross and there's no going back. And that, I really think that's where Germany is headed. Just some of the points that Ischinger makes. So he's not on board with this. He thinks it's going to let a genie out of the bottle and Germany's going to checkmate itself. There'll be no going back from some of the decisions it's about to make and it's making. If Germany were now to break out of its non-nuclear power status, he writes, what would keep Turkey or Poland, for instance, from following suit? That's a good question. Germany, he says, as a gravedigger of the international non-proliferation regime, who could want that? That's a fair question. If Germany goes after nuclear weapons, will that start an arms race in Europe? What about Turkey? You could see Turkey right now and the state it's in, and Erdogan, you could see him wanting nuclear weapons, particularly if Germany develops nuclear weapons. Second, a German nuclear bomb would damage the strategic environment in Europe to Germany's disadvantage. Russia would interpret German steps toward a nuclear arsenal as a direct threat to its national security and would likely adopt military countermeasures. So Russia would be compelled to respond. You know, now a lot of people would argue that the advantages of having nuclear weapons for Germany outweigh the disadvantages. But as Ischinger points out here, what's Russia's response going to be? And maybe the warming relations, or maybe the close relations between Russia and Germany right now, you know, this is part of it. Germany wants to assuage Russia's concerns as it, you know, looks at acquiring nuclear weapons. Vladimir Putin, I think, is in Germany tomorrow. That's certainly a visit that we'll want to watch and that we probably won't hear too much about. And then I just wanted to conclude with this quote from Ischinger. The best way, he says, the best way to maintain NATO's credibility and be taken seriously by America is to work seriously toward the alliance's 2% of GDP target for defense spending and to invest more heavily in conventional military capabilities, not just to satisfy U.S. demands, but to protect our own security and defense interests. So that's interesting, isn't it? Whether or not, and that's you know, one of the points I wanted to make here, whether or not Germany acquires nuclear weapons, and I think they will. Mr. Armstrong said that they will. You look at Bible prophecy and how much nuclear proliferation and nuclear war is occurring in the end time right before the return of Christ. And, you know, Germany is going to have nuclear weapons or have access to nuclear weapons. It's maybe it gets control of France's somehow. But even if it takes a while, even if it doesn't happen, one thing that is happening, just because this conversation is underway, is Germany is arming itself or growing and expanding its conventional military. All of these individuals like Ischinger, who they argue that, you know, Germany should not become a nuclear state. Germany should not acquire nuclear weapons. But they agree and they accept that Germany must build its military, conventional military. They must get more planes and more tanks. It's not coincidence that over the past week or two, we've also seen in Germany a discussion begin to take place about conscription. And more and more individuals, more and more politicians. The woman who the CSU, I forget her name, the CSU politician who many believe will replace Angela Merkel, she's the one that raised it. We may need to have a conscription army again. And people are talking about it. I think one poll showed that most Germans support a conscription. This is a big story. This is a huge story. A huge story that we're just not seeing in the news. We're just not seeing this on the BBC each night. We're just not seeing this on Fox News or CNN. And this is really, I think this is one of the most significant trends in the world right now. It's one of the most significant trends in the world right now. The change taking place in Germany's military and security posture. The way Germany is becoming more assertive, more self-reliant. The way it's assuming more leadership in Europe. The way that it's now accepted, even a few years ago it wasn't accepted, that Germany should grow its conventional military, expand its conventional military. Now it's accepted. Everyone agrees that Germany needs a bigger, stronger conventional military. A major change has taken place there, even a change since just a few years ago. It's a big story, and we don't see this in the news. You don't see this on the front page of our newspapers. It's just another example of a story that you haven't seen, you haven't heard. But there's a whole host of examples of significant news, of relevant facts, of important trends that just aren't being reported. Or if they are being reported on, you know, they're being underreported. Just, I had another couple of examples here. This one is, I mean, it's a pretty meager example. This came out this week as well. Did you know that most women do not consider themselves feminist? The results of a poll that was performed in America were released last week, and they showed that most women do not consider themselves feminist. This is from a YouGov article from yesterday, I think. Feminism might be on the rise, but many women aren't on board. Though slightly more women consider themselves feminist now, 38%, than did in 2016, close to half of women still say they are not feminists. See, that's interesting. If you were to watch the BBC or listen to CNN or read the mainstream news, and I mean the tone behind the Me Too movement, I mean, you'd get the impression that every woman in this world is a feminist. You'd get the impression that, you know, being a feminist is now a mainstream point of view for women. In a lot of instances, women are made to feel bad if they don't subscribe to feminist ideology. But in fact, the stats show that a majority of women aren't feminist. I'm sure, here's another example. It's not an example of important news not being reported, but I think it's an example of important news. While it's being reported, it won't be considered and evaluated and analyzed to the extent that it really ought to be. Lessons won't be drawn, or let's say the most important lessons won't be drawn from this news event. This news came out this week. It received quite a bit of attention, really. A lot of people are just really horrified and disgusted by it. But I'm talking about the report that was released this week that exposes the horrific behavior of some Catholic priests in Pennsylvania. This report was more than 1,300 pages long, and it just documents some of the most disgusting criminal behavior that you could possibly imagine. As I said, the report has received quite a bit of attention. A lot of people are pretty horrified and disgusted, as we should be. But, you know, there are some important and searching facts in this story that haven't yet been explored, and they're not getting the attention that they deserve and that they need. And honestly, I'm not sure if they will get the attention. There's some facets to this story that I don't think will ever get the attention that they deserve. There was more to this story than some priests committing some atrocious acts. The report released this week showed that many leading figures inside the Catholic Church were aware of the behavior and conduct of these priests. And instead of being defrocked and turned over to the police, these individuals, they had their crimes covered up by officials and leaders in the church. Again, you know, this story is, it's in all the media, but are we really analyzing it? Are we really drawing the lessons inherent within this story, the important lessons inherent with this in this story? You know, there's lessons here about church government and the organization of the Catholic Church and the way it functions and operates and the level of transparency and accountability. There are lessons in this about, you know, the doctrines of the Catholic Church. There's a lot to be learned. There's a lot to be studied. But it's very likely that while the media will report on this 1,356-page report that was produced, they probably won't analyze it and learn lessons from it and think about why it happened and how it can be changed. There's a lot to unpackage and learn and digest in the news coming out of Pennsylvania. And I'm just not sure that will happen. I wanted to conclude, though, because as I said at the beginning, what I'm talking about today is a news item. The fact that the mainstream media is not reporting on important news is news itself, and it's prophetically significant news. There's a prophecy in Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 10, and it's really talking about the nations of Israel in this end time. And again, there's spiritual applications, but there's also the physical application to the nations of Israel, to America and Britain. And this is what the prophet Isaiah wrote. And he's talking about our nations right before the return of Jesus Christ. And this is what he wrote, "Which say to the seers, see not, and to the prophets, prophesy not unto us right things. Speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. Get you out of the way, turn aside out of the path, cause the Holy One of Israel to cease from before us." So this is a prophecy about the end time, and as this prophecy indicates, the people have a responsibility for the behavior of the media. The media is responsible. Our leaders are responsible, as Isaiah talks about in chapter 3. They're responsible. But here we see the people saying to the seers, see not, saying to the prophets, prophesy not, saying to their leaders, speak unto us smooth things, prophesy deceits. You know, in a lot of ways, to somewhat defend the likes of the BBC and others, in a lot of ways, they're just giving the people what the people want. They're just giving the people what the people need. What the people can handle. You know, some of these news organizations, if they were to speak the truth, they'd be shouted down. They'd get in trouble. Now, as we saw with Winston Churchill, that doesn't mean you don't do it. Even if it makes you popular, unpopular, you still need to declare the truth. You still need to address the issues, talk about the issues, even if it makes you unpopular. But the people have a responsibility in this. They're the ones that tell their leaders to see not. They're the ones that tell their leaders to prophesy not. They're the ones begging to be told smooth things. They want their leaders to prophesy deceits, and that's what they're getting. Just a quote here from Mr. Gerald Flurry. This is from the Rising Beast booklet. This is what he writes about this chapter here in Isaiah, this prophecy here in Isaiah. "Our indulgent press," and that he's quoting Winston Churchill there, "our indulgent press leaves many of our people confused because its writings are so vague and lacking in facts." He's absolutely right. All of the writings, 98% of the writings on the car fires in Sweden this week were vague and lacking in facts, lacking in important facts. Mr. Flurry continues, "Too often they report smooth things and call the truth alarmist." That's exactly right. If you want to speak the truth about some of these issues, you're called an alarmist. In some cases, you can be locked away for hate speech. Mr. Flurry continues, "But we are going to have to lay aside the easy, pleasurable way if we heed God's warning. See, the truth can be hard to hear sometimes, but we need to hear it. We don't need smooth things. We don't need smooth things. We need to hear the truth. We need to hear hard things. We need an accurate view of reality. Before you can solve problems, you have to identify problems. And in order to identify problems, you have to talk about them. You have to talk about them. And we're just not doing that. We're not talking about the issues that will and are impacting our nations, our communities, our families, our lives. We really do need to, personally, individually, you know, we can change this. We can't change the BBC. We can't change the mainstream media. But we certainly can make sure that we're watching world events, that we're searching out the important stories. And a great way to watch world events and keep up with the important stories and the prophetically significant stories is to stay tuned to thetrumpet.com. But just in conclusion, I thought I'd conclude with a quote from Christ himself. This is what Jesus warned and admonished us in Luke 21, verse 36. Watch you therefore and pray always. Watch you therefore and pray always that you may be accounted worthy to escape. So the onus is on you and me. We have a responsibility to watch, and maybe the mainstream media is not helping us do that. Maybe they're impairing our ability to do that. But there are ways to do it. You can watch. You can know what's happening in the world. You can know what's going on. You can know where it's all leading. You can know the cause of so many of the problems that we see around us. But it really is incumbent upon us to make the effort to watch, to make the effort to be interested, to make the effort to learn, and then, as Christ says, to respond to what we learn spiritually, to respond by praying and studying, drawing closer to God. Okay, I'll leave it there. It's great to be with you. Thanks for listening.